Okay, welcome everybody to our favorite hour on Thursday. Do. I feel like we should have some intro music. All right, so we're doing Malbim on Mishlei, the Book of Proverbs. We are on page 210, chapter 20. And today we're going to be talking about, this is actually a theme, not a theme, I should say a technique that is used many times in this book. The technique being that we, the author presents a metaphor and we unpack the metaphor, and the metaphor itself has wisdom for us. But then there's the meaning of the metaphor, and that is also true. That is also another message for us. So each verse will have two layers of meaning: the meaning, the literal meaning of the metaphor, and then the symbolic meaning of the metaphor. So we're going to unravel that as we go. Okay. Hi, April. Good to see you. Okay. So verse 16, we're on page 210 and 211. Lekach bigdo ki arav zar. Take his garment, who has given surety for a stranger, uba'ad nachriyah havlehu, and hold him in pledge, who goes surety for an alien woman. Okay, so you might be thinking to yourself, what the heck does this mean? Because, right? Because some of the verses are easier to understand than others. So let's just plain English, like, what is this talking about? All right, so here's the metaphor. Okay, the metaphor given surety means that you are basically serving as a guarantor for another person. Okay, so you're saying, I am vouching for this person, and I'm willing to put up my own money for them. And if they don't deliver, then I am going to pay for them. I'm going to vouch. I'm going to stick up for them. So if you act as a guarantor for another person, you should just know that you might lose your shirt. Okay. Take his garment. You might lose your shirt. And what about if you go surety for an alien woman? What about if you're willing to be a guarantor or to vouch for an alien woman? What's an alien woman? So in the metaphor, we're talking about the other woman, somebody who, this would be a metaphor of a married man who is in a relationship with another woman, right? And he is giving her his money, and he is taking care of her, and he's vouching for her. Hold him in pledge. That means that he is going to have to answer. He's going to have to pay for any mistakes that are made in that relationship. Okay, so we can tell that this verse is talking about not a good kind of being a guarantor for another person, not like where it's an act of kindness, like your friend needs a loan and will you take responsibility for your friend and vouch for him. We're not talking about that here. Here we're talking about a person who you can't trust. And now you have put your name on the line for that person. And maybe it's a person that you shouldn't even be in a relationship in the first place. And just so you know, there are consequences to that relationship, and there are consequences to those promises. Okay. That's the metaphor. All right. So now let's unpack the actual Hebrew and see what are the different words that we're talking about here, right? And what do they mean? All right. So first of all, I want to welcome Lauren. I haven't seen you in forever. It's wonderful to see your face on our call. Hi, Lauren. I don't know if you can hear me. And Naomi as well. I don't know which Naomi that is, but welcome. Okay. So the word zar, it says, Lekach bigdo ki arav zar, take his garment, who has given surety for a stranger. So we need to understand, what does that mean, a stranger? Okay. And oh, Naomi Rotter, of course. I knew that was you. Okay, and then in the final half of the verse, we say Nachriya. Nachriya also means, like, it's translated here as alien. So in the first half of the verse, we're talking about a stranger. In the second half of the verse, we're talking about someone who is alien. So what are these two categories? What is the metaphor referring to? Who is this person that we've taken responsibility for, that we're being warned that there will be consequences to pay for that? All right. So, if you go to the commentary on page 210, this is what it says. A stranger, czar, is a person from another homesteader city. So this is a person that is still within your community, meaning they're still Jewish, but they're from another place. You don't know them personally. An alien, Nahri or Nahriya for the feminine version, is from another country. So the first one is somebody who is, well, no, actually does, we're not talking about Jewish yet. That's the meaning of the metaphor. In the metaphor, the first half of the verse is talking about somebody who is from your country, but they're not from your city. They're not your immediate neighbor. A Nahri is somebody who's from another country. Going surety for a stranger, meaning the person who's still in your country but not from your community, can make a person lose his shirt, but his body is left untouched. Okay, so you might lose your money, but your inherent personhood is still left undamaged, so to speak, or untainted, we might say. Right? You still remain the same person. You haven't sold yourself out. You might lose your money, okay? Hello, Dana and Debbie. Nice to see you guys. With an alien, so now we're talking about this person from another country, he may suffer physically too. So now you've given your money to a total stranger. You might even find your own body in harm's way. Metaphor, but why? Because you don't know anything about that person and you don't know anything about their culture. Or what might they do to you? Or what are the rules in some other country? They may not be the same as the rules in your country. So you might be physically in danger. It's not just about losing your money. That's the metaphor. Okay. So basically, what the author is warning us about is to be very careful who you're willing to put down your money for. For the right person, it's a tremendous mitzvah. For a good person, an honest person, a person with integrity. That's a tremendous mitzvah to be a guarantor for another person. And if that's something that you're able to do financially and you're willing to pay, if you can, great, beautiful. That's a tremendous act of tzedakah and chesed, kindness. But if it's a person you don't know, you have to understand that you're undertaking risk. And that might be risk to your dollars, and that might be risk to you personally. It might harm you personally. So you want to be very, very judicious about who you're willing to throw in your lot with. You know, you're investing in some sort of venture in some other country. You don't have no idea who this person is, and you have no idea what they're going to do, you know, or what people do in that country, or there's no law, you know, there's no system of law in some other country. It's a corrupt country. You really don't know. You don't know what you're up against. That's the metaphor. What's the meaning of the metaphor? Metaphorically, it means that adopting false conceptions and philosophies in place of the Torah's teachings is like sinning with a strange woman and being saddled with the burden of surety for her. So what that means is that you're willing to sell yourself out Jewishly. That's the metaphor, where you become very close with people in other religions. And then you start to find the beauty in their religion. And then you start to step out of the lines of your own religion. And it becomes really easy in our culture. It's very easy for a Jew to marry a non-Jew. It happens literally all the time. Back in the day, it was considered a tragedy of epic proportions. Do you guys remember Fiddler on the Roof? When his third daughter, I forgot if it was Chava or Huddle, married the non-Jew, and it was like a tragedy. People used to sit Shiva when their kids married a non-Jew. They were dead to them. It cut them out of their life. Now that's not the way we practice anymore today. It was never a practice that was sort of, you know, deemed necessary by rabbis. It was just something that people did so organically because they couldn't imagine such a thing happening. So that's not recommended anymore today. Today, the prevailing wisdom is that we hold our kids close because, God willing, they can get reconnected to Judaism and maybe their spouse will get connected to Judaism or their kids will get, you know, so that's the prevailing wisdom today. But nevertheless, you know, it is considered a tremendous breach when a Jew marries a non-Jew. And it's a big deal in Judaism. And what it's saying here is that, being saddled with the burden of surety for her. So here it's not even talking about a marriage, it's talking about an affair. And now this man who's trying to have it both ways. You want to have your wife at home and you want to have your mistress in some hotel room, and you're going to have to be responsible for her now. You're going to have to be responsible. She's in a relationship with you. She cares about you. She wants something from you. You can't just, dabble in these relationships and just think that there's going to be no consequences. There is no such thing in life. There will be consequences. This will cost him the garment of spirituality every Jewish soul acquired at Sinai. So when we use this expression, he might lose his shirt, right? Well, that's financial, obviously. But what we're also talking about is that every Jew who stood at Sinai and said, essentially, I do, I we will do and we will hear, na'aseh v'nishma, I am in for this religion, and I want to be in with this relationship with Judaism, and I want to be in with my relationship with God. We were all given like a spiritual cloak at Mount Sinai. That's what the Torah teaches. So if a person starts sinning with an alien woman, going outside the bounds of Judaism and dabbling in these forbidden relationships, it's like he's losing his shirt. Are you trading your Jewish purity and connection for these, fleeting but pleasurable and burdensome relationships? Affairs really make no sense, but people don't commit affairs because they make sense. They commit them emotionally, and they force themselves not to think of the consequences. Because if anybody would think of the consequences, they would recognize that they are undoubtedly ruining their lives. There is no happy ending to an affair, even if nobody finds out, but the person themselves, there's secrets in the relationship and there's guilt that can never be shed. So there's no such thing as engaging in these activities and not having there be consequences. And the metaphor is that a Jewish person is in a relationship. You're in a relationship with Judaism. Right? And just like it's a monotheistic religion, it's also a monogamous relationship. We are in a monogamous relationship with Judaism. Don't cheat on Judaism with other places and other practices and other, streams of spirituality or other houses or places of worship. A Jew is not supposed to go into other houses of worship, particularly idolatry. Temples in India and shrines and all of these things, those are highly problematic places for a Jew to visit. That's considered, going out of the bounds of Judaism. Sinning with an alien woman is a metaphor for espousing heresy, idolatry. I don't know if any of you remember or were aware of this happening at the time, but a number of years ago, I'm thinking 10 years ago, maybe more, there was a huge controversy with wigs. So, many religious women cover their hair with a wig. So, in case you guys didn't know, this beautiful hair is not mine, but I can tell you where to buy some. And there was this huge controversy because it was discovered that some of the wigs that, religious Jewish women were buying originated with Indian hair. Do any of you guys remember this this whole scandal that came about? Okay.
We
So,
talked about this at L'Chaim Center on Shabbat.
are
And
you
that was
kidding me?
no.
That's bizarre. I love it. I love it. Okay. So apparently there's some kind of ritual where Indian women, and believe me, this is totally not my wheelhouse, so I could very well be getting this wrong. And if you guys have more information, please chime in and correct me. Where they either cut their, they grow their hair for a long time and then they either cut it or shave it. I don't remember. And they bring their hair as an offering to the gods in these temples. And then what is done with the hair? Well, nobody, it's considered an offering to the gods. So what some entrepreneurs do is they scoop up the hair and they sell it for wigs. So it came to light. Yeah. Did I get that right? You guys, Chicagoans, something like that. Okay. Anyway, so all of a sudden, somebody discovered this, and all of a sudden, people were like, well, if I am wearing a wig with Indian hair, where the hair was brought as an offering to the gods, am I even allowed to get benefit from it? Am I allowed to get a benefit from something that was utilized for idolatry? Because idolatry is one of the, there are a few things in the Torah which are like huge no-nos. There are some things that are like, ah, you really shouldn't do this, but if you do, hey, we still love you. Idolatry is not one of those things. It's a big deal. You know, it's the Ten Commandments. It's like the one of the three cardinal sins that a person should rather be killed than serve some foreign god. It's like really, you know, a big deal in Judaism. So what happened was it took about a week, I think, until they verified which wigs were problematic or not problematic. You could wear them, you couldn't wear them. And a whole bunch of women, which I happen to wear a lot of scarves, so to me that's like not a big deal. But there are some women who are like they're very like conservative, not conservative as opposed to orthodox. I mean, like not like hippy dippy like me. Like they're always well coiffed with like their wigs, or they're professional women. They only wear wigs to work, you know, lawyers or accountants or what have you. And they did not wear their wigs for a full week until it was discovered like what the problem was, until there was clarity on the issue, because they wanted to stay a million miles away from anything even sniffing like idolatry. It was this whole phenomenon, I'm telling you. It was like if it would have been like more in the Instagram age, there would have been a thousand memes and jokes floating around about it, you know. But like I said, it was a little while ago. 2000, oh, so 20 years ago. Wow. Okay. Interesting. Very interesting. So, you know, this is like really a big deal, and this is what the commentary is saying here, is that this is something that you want to stay far, far away from. There's like a neon light, danger, 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 do not engage in this. Tammy asks, what are the other two cardinal sins that you should rather die for? So the three are idolatry, adultery, and murder. Those are the three. Okay, so to finish up the commentary, sinning with an alien woman is a metaphor for espousing heresy, idolatry. For this, a person will be bodily punished. So before we said, right, you might lose your shirt, you might lose your cloak that you got at Sinai, you might lose that special thing. But idolatry, that's the part of the metaphor where we said that could actually cause you physical bodily harm, right? Consciously and knowingly engaging in a spiritual practice outside of Judaism, that person could be bodily punished for it. They might be, you know, get physically harmed as a punishment for engaging in that, expelled from the people of Hashem to her alien domain to bear responsibility for his enormous sin. Now, I always like to try and make these teachings as practical as possible, right? So when we talk about idolatry, I'm talking about real idolatry, like other religions. Okay. So it's very interesting to note that back in the day when people were very spiritual, atheism was not a thing. The main temptation that a Jew had was to worship another god. It wasn't to say there is no god. When the Jews were first going into Israel, right, at the end of the Torah, the fifth book of the five books of Moses is a speech by Moses to the Jewish people, his deathbed speech, which lasted for 37 days. That's the whole final book of the Torah, the whole book of Devarim, Deuteronomy. And in it, Moses says over and over and over again in many different ways, please, please, please do not worship the foreign gods that you will encounter in the land of Israel. Please, I beg you, do not. He says it many times in many different ways, in such heartfelt, emotionally laden words. Here's what's going to happen. You're going to get to the land of Israel, and there's going to be foreign nations there, and they're going to be engaging in all these practices. Please, I beg you, do not worship them. And some of them are going to have very bizarre practices. In those days, it was, you know, cruel, brutal pagan worship. They would bring their firstborns up on the altar, and they would pass their children through the fire, and just all kinds of just horrific, bizarre stuff. You know, they would like defecate in front of these idols, like just crazy practices. And the Jewish people were tempted to follow these practices, and many of them did. Idolatry was a huge problem when they got to the land of Israel, and it lasted for hundreds of years. And then what happened was, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly, which was, I think, towards the end of the First Temple era, so 1,000 years after they got into the land of Israel, the problem of idolatry was so rampant and so bad that they prayed to God to take away the drive for idolatry. What was the drive for idolatry? It was that a person, the people had such a spiritual drive. It was such an overwhelming spiritual drive And it started out by them saying, I'm not worthy to have a one-on-one personal relationship with God. So instead, I'm going to worship God's emissaries. So I'm going to worship the sun because the sun is a function of God. And I'm going to worship the moon because the moon is a function of God. And I'm going to worship this statue because this statue is my manifestation of God. And then eventually they forgot about the God piece. And they thought that the sun has power and that the moon has power and that the statue has power. And the men of the Great Assembly prayed to God and say, please, this problem of idolatry is taking over our nation. I need you, God, to please take away the Yetzer Hara for idolatry. So God said, I'm willing to do it. But if I take away the Yetzer Hara, the drive, the negative drive for idolatry, I have to also take away something positive because otherwise people will have no free will. It will just be so obvious to serve God. It won't even be a meaningful choice. So what I also have to take away at the same time is prophecy. The same way there's no overt drive to worship something negative, there will also be no overt communication from something positive. And the men of the Great Assembly said, yes, we need to do it because idolatry is killing the nation. So God said, okay. Now, when that happened, the main spiritual downfall of the Jewish people shifted from idolatry to atheism. Instead of the drive being to worship another God, the drive became to deny God. And that's where we are today. So it's very hard for us when we learn these concepts of idolatry to be like, why would anybody donate their hair to a God? Why would anybody poop in front of an idol? Like, I seriously, we don't even under it's so bizarre because we don't have the Yetzer Hara for idolatry. That's why we don't understand it. You know what our temptation is? Our temptation is to not see God, to deny God, to say that there's other powers that are stronger than God, or other powers that we might not necessarily say intellectually that are stronger than God, but we act as though they're stronger than God. Whether it's the economy or medicine or ego or power or status or wealth or ourselves, celebrities, entertainment, athletes, right? And we give those things and people a lot of esteem and value, and we forget that God runs the world. That's our idolatry. Now, that's not as bad as idolatry, idolatry, right? It's not the second commandment. The first commandment is to believe in God. The second commandment is don't worship any other power than God. So one could say that is idolatry. That isn't idolatry. I don't know exactly technically if it would, but just to understand why we don't seem to have this drive, but what our pitfall and downfall is instead. And so what we can take away from this verse, Heather, I see you. I'm going to get to you in a moment. What we can take away from this verse is that we want to make sure that we're not kind of dabbling outside the boundaries of Judaism by ascribing power to other forces or entities that are not God. And also, and I know for some of you, this is going to be difficult to hear, a Jew is really not supposed to go into a church and participate in a church service. And I know people have friends who are not Jewish and they have, weddings and occasions and things. If a person has a specific occasion that they feel they would really hurt somebody's feelings, go talk to your rabbi about that. But some people just go because they're like, oh, I don't know, I'm curious. I'll go with my friend, see what this is about. A Jew is not supposed to do that. Spirituality is supposed to be sought only in our own backyard, and there's plenty of it, and it's beautiful and rich and deep. We do not have to go grazing in other pastures to find what we're looking for. Heather.
I just want to know if I can be forgiven for at times wishing that I had sacrificed my child to a god.
I forgive you, my daughter.
Okay, good. Thank you. It's like, uh-oh, there's been times that I've wanted to do that.
You know, we're not punished for what we want to do. We're just punished for what we actually do. So I'm going to say you're good.
Okay, good. And the thing
Really?
about the churches, I know it's hard for sure, but I have checked with Rabbi Koval about certain instances, and like he's actually come up with very creative ways for me to have like been just outside in the parking lot of the church so that when the people come out and are just like, that was a great service, wasn't it? And I was just like, yes. I'm so happy that you felt comforted by the service. Like that's so
That's
anyway.
great, Heather. And I'm
I'm glad
glad you brought that up because I think it's important for people to know, that Judaism is a compassionate and benevolent religion. And, if there is a sensitive social situation, a good rabbi, like my husband, will try to, as you said, come up with creative solutions that are still within the bounds of halacha, of Jewish law, to be able to not be hurtful to a person who's special in your life or whatever the case may be.
He was great. That we can go to the house afterwards, and it also. Oh, go on. Sorry.
Oh, sorry, Heather.
Yeah, go ahead, Heather, finish up.
No, that's okay. I'm done. Thank you so much.
Okay. Tammy, and then Adrian.
So I'm part of Greater Cleveland Congregations. And we have events at churches all the time. I mean, we kind of move around to, like, there's synagogues involved, there's churches, there's other organizations involved in GCC. They're not like the Sunday service, but they take place in churches. Sometimes there's gospel singers. There could be prayers, though they are conscious of the fact that Jews are members, so they do try not to make it overtly Christian, like they don't talk about Jesus or something in the prayer that they lead in with or something like that. But that's not what you mean when you say we're prohibited from a service. You mean like an actual service, like when I was a bridesmaid in a mass. That's what you mean.
Oh,
I did not go up and I did not take communion.
good. Oh my gosh,
I didn't even know I wasn't allowed to be there.
wow. Okay, so that would definitely be a good thing to discuss with a rabbi. I could recommend one. But I will say that I know that there are people who attend religious Jews who attend 12-step programs in churches. And the guidance that they're given is that if there is a need, if there is a specific demonstrable need, then you can go in a church as long as it's not in the chapel. Going in the chapel is different. And so, again, like I would discuss these specifics with a rabbi in terms of what is the need. But again, there's nothing Christian happening in those meetings. Some meetings are actually more Christian. It really depends on the meeting. If I were in a meeting where they were talking about Christian things or Christian prayers, I would ask my rabbi, like, what should I do about that? So there is definitely wiggle room to some degree. The question is, what is the need? What is happening there? Which part of the church is it happening in?
Interesting. Okay. Because often that, when we have hundreds of people congregating, like for like with political candidates on a stage, we are doing in the largest room available, which might be the chapel, like a large chapel.
I know, I don't even know what it's called. I was going to say the sanctuary, and then I was like, I don't know. Is that a Jewish word? Like, I don't know.
I don't
Christianity
know.
is not my specialty.
Mine either. Apparently, I'm attending too many churches. And you know what else? Awesome. When we went to Europe, we went to Notre Dame. We went to all kinds of churches. We were there before it
Yeah,
burned.
that's very common that people do that. Again, like a person who is sensitive to halacha and Jewish law should discuss those things with a rabbi prior to booking that kind of a trip. Actually, I'll tell you something interesting, and then we'll move on. Oh, Adrian, I wanted to get to you, but I'll just mention that after 1948, when the Jews started, well, before 1948, really, when the Jews started moving en masse back to Israel, many religious Jews did not want to live in Jerusalem because of the many churches that were there. And in fact, I know this is funny to think about now, many religious Jews started out in Tel Aviv, which is now such a secular city because it was a new city and it did not have churches because it was not occupied by Rome for thousands of years. So, like my mother-in-law, who was born into a very religious family, she was born in Israel in 1948 and she lived in Tel Aviv. because they didn't want to be surrounded by all those churches. So it's just, such an interesting thing to think about. Now, Jerusalem is the religious city and Tel Aviv is the secular city, but there are still no churches in Tel Aviv because Tel Aviv never had a Christian presence. Adrian.
Excuse me. So over the course of years of learning, we have often discussed how in the modern world money has been elevated to the status of idol worship, put above other things, and it's problematic in today's world. Our
Absolutely.
material world and money and what it means and how important it is, and what you sacrifice for it, and it's something to think about.
That's a great observation. And I will also add to that that there's a certain worship of wealthy people, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good observation. Thank you. Okay, let's go on to verse 17. Arev la'ish lechem sheker, bread of falsehood is sweet to a man, va'achar yimalei pihu chatzatz, but afterwards his mouth will be filled with gravel. Okay, so again, this is a metaphor. We're talking about a person who's eating something that's bread of falsehood, which ironically, I mean, when this book was written, they didn't have this technology, but it's like white bread, right? Wonder bread. What's wonderful about it? They took out everything nutritious. That's what's wonderful about it. They took out all the fiber and all the grains and all the stuff that actually gives nutrition to your body, right? So you eat this bread. It's fake bread. It's bread of falsehood. These breads can sit on the shelf of a supermarket and stay fresh for weeks. I don't even want to know what's in there, right? And this is the stuff we're putting in our bodies. Me too, right? So it tastes sweet when you first eat it. It tastes sweet, but afterwards his mouth will be filled with gravel. So very often afterwards we don't feel good. We don't feel full. We don't feel satiated. Maybe we even feel yuck. Why did I eat junk food? I didn't want junk food. I was craving real food. So here, that's the metaphor. The metaphor is about food. The meaning of the metaphor, right? So here we go. This is a commentary. Wealth acquired by deceit at first seems especially enjoyable. So that's a direct continuation of what you were saying, Adrian, that a person who achieves wealth by deceit. You made money because you sneaked out of your taxes and you didn't declare this and this was just cash only and you feel really good. You feel really smart. You beat the system. You did it. And it tastes really sweet in the beginning since it has come without effort. But eventually retribution falls. One day you're going to pay for that. You can't get away with that stuff forever. It's going to catch up with you. And the enjoyment changes to regret. So then it's a sour taste in your mouth. You feel gross about it. You feel yuck. Symbolically, this refers to heresies and alien philosophies that seem attractive at first, but afterwards torment one's spiritual nature. That a person, again, we're going back to this idea of a Jew, kind of trying out other religions. And, there's a reason that Jews are attracted to all these Eastern religions, and so many Jews are into Buddhism and, Eastern meditation and, all of these spiritual energy healer types. I forgot the number, but I think that at one point, 30% of non-Eastern Buddhist leaders were Jewish. Okay, now if you think about what a teeny tiny percent of the whole universe we are, does that make any sense? But we see Jews are attracted to this stuff. We're specifically attracted to this stuff. I've mentioned this book before and I'll mention it again because it was so fascinating and so it really stuck with me. And I read this book ages and ages ago. There's this guy, his name is David Gartenstein Ross, and he wrote a memoir called My Year Inside Radical Islam. So he was a Jew who had been raised very humanitarian, non-religious, non-spiritual, in a Jewish home. And he was never exposed to spirituality. And he got to the college campuses and he discovered Islam. And he found these friends and they were very into it and they were very spiritual and they prayed and they wore these like sort of white yarmulke type head coverings. And he was really attracted by it. It was the first time in his whole life that he had encountered anything like this. And he got super into it. Actually, we have a speaker coming in. It's the weekend right before Yom HaAtzmaut. She's coming in from Israel and she's going to speak about Israel. Her name is Shannon Newson. She was a former evangelical Christian missionary and she became a religious Jew. And she's going to tell her story and talk about life in Israel right now. So, Clevelanders, keep your eye open for that. Non-Clevelanders, you're invited to come to us for Shabbat. So, in any event, what was so heartbreaking about this story was that he started with such beautiful intentions. He wanted to be connected, and you could almost see his like Jewish soul being so thirsty, for a meaning and for the concept of a good deed and for the concept of prayer and for the concept of belonging to a special nation, And eventually he gets more and more and more into this Islam and he gets into more and more and more radical circles. And eventually he gets a job at this nonprofit. And after a while, he discovers that there's something sinister going on and that this organization that he works for is actually funding terror in the Middle East. And he becomes completely disenfranchised from it. And he has this whole crisis of faith. And eventually he meets a Christian woman and he marries her. And I'm like, that cannot be the end of the story. No, he needs to marry someone Jewish and they need to ride off into the sunset under the chuppah. But okay, that wasn't the story. But that's really exactly what this verse is telling us, that these alien philosophies seem attractive at first, but afterwards torment one's spiritual nature. This guy was a Jew and he had a Jewish soul, and the Jewish soul is thirsty for Jewish spirituality. And when you fill it with other things, at first it's so cool that this is so exotic, Oh, this is what goes on. This is, Buddhist med, even yoga. So many Jews are into yoga, and yoga for a while was controversial. Like, is this a thing that Jews should be participating in? I have one mentor who is really like not a fan. She's like, it's true that it's not a religion anymore, but these are the poses of Buddhist, Hindu religion. Why would a Jew want to do them? Now, I do practice yoga. I go to a studio which is very non-Buddhist and non-religious, and it's really very like American FACO yoga. But and I find that it brings me tremendous benefits in many ways. But it's not so simple. There's a lot of discussion about yoga, and why are so many Jews attracted to these things? Because we have a thirsty soul. So let's make sure that we're feeding our hungry and thirsty soul what it really needs, the true nourishment that has like, yeah. And you know what? Sometimes it's hard to digest, right? Wonder Bread is easy to digest. It goes right down. Fiber is harder to digest, but Judaism is like, it's gritty. It's got teeth, and sometimes it takes time to digest it and you're gonna have to work on it, but then it can offer you so much nourishment and so much it just feeds you. It feeds your soul. It's what your soul needs. So we want to make sure that that's what we're feeding ourselves, and there's so many different ways to feed your soul in Judaism. It can be through prayer. It doesn't have to be. Prayer can be private or communal. It can be through Torah study. Some people are not that academic and that's not where they connect to. It can be social. It can be acts of kindness and volunteering. It can be getting into Israel. There's so many ways to connect to Judaism to feed your specific soul. What does your soul crave? But whatever it is that you're thirsty for or hungry for, try to see if you can fill that need within the realm of Judaism because it is there. There's many different forms of Judaism. There's Hasidic Judaism. There's academic Judaism. There's, Breslov, sing and dance and God wants you to be happy all day Judaism. I have a friend in Israel who they're like very straight-laced Orthodox, like, and her kid is super, super duper hippy dippy Breslov. For those of you who know what Breslov is, anyway, her kid just got married. I watched the chuppah on Zoom. They literally got married in a forest. Pretty sure bride and groom were barefoot. The groom was wearing this like white linen tunic set with a white turban. It was so amazing and so authentic. Authentic and so crunchy granola. Like, you want that? You can find that in Judaism. Whatever you want, you can find it in Judaism. It's beautiful. It's magnificent. But Judaism does want us to stay within the lines of Judaism and don't go shopping in other people's backyards. That's not what we're here for.
Now,
Okay. Yeah, Laura.
you have said before, I mean, we we do know, we know this, but unfortunately the education that most American, at least Jews, get does not have a lot of spirituality in it. And it's really problematic. And the other book, and I know it's been mentioned, Letters from a Buddhist Jew. That's a really interesting one too.
Yeah, that is a really...
He goes the way I think you want him to go. So the ending is a little better.
He's a Chicago guy, right?
Yeah.
Isn't he from the North Shore or something?
Yeah, and I saw the book. I was in someone's home for Shabbat dinner in Jerusalem, and this was this a couple from like New Jersey or wherever, and they were kind of figuring themselves out, and ultimately this guy was reading this book, and they eventually became the guy that I was in the home of was Baal Tshuva, and he had been super kind of into Buddhism. And he was kind of figuring things out. And then he was like, oh, I had no idea that Judaism was part of, you know, could be part of this same spiritual feeling that I'm feeling.
Yeah.
Super interesting.
So for those of you who are not familiar, there's this book written by Rabbi Akiva Tatz, who is originally South African. Now he lives in London. He lived in Israel for many years. He's a doctor and a rabbi. And he was in communication with this Buju, right? As Adrian, I never remember if it's a Jubu or a Buju or whatever. It's a Jubu. Okay. I want to make sure to get my terms right. This gentleman from the Chicago suburbs, you know, a regular, nice Jewish guy. And I guess somebody recommended that he start writing him letters. And the book is a record of their letters back and forth. Is his name David Gottlieb? I think his name is. Yeah.
And his wife, I think, was very upset by his, you know, interest in Buddhism. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, so maybe she
was part of it. As I recall, I read it a long time ago.
It's fascinating. I will say that Rabbi Tatz is a brilliant genius. And some of his responses, I feel like you need to like read it several times to figure out what he's saying. But if this is the topic that interests you, it is a very worthy read. I'll just type the title here in case anybody wants to read it. And one of the themes that comes up all the time in this book is about, you know, David saying, but this is something I find really meaningful in Buddhism. And Rabbi Tatz telling him, well, here's really where you'll find it in Judaism. And then he's like, well, why didn't anybody ever tell me? That's kind of like the pattern of the whole book. You know, so okay. So as I mentioned, I do have to go at 12:45. But thank you everybody for participating today. It was awesome to be with all of you as always. Have a beautiful Thursday and Shabbat Shalom, and enjoy all your challah. And God willing, I will see you soon.
Bye,
guys.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.